Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
I don't know, Mrs. Bates.
Cheryl was sobbing into the phone.
We just found Kimmy on the couch and couldn't wake her, so we called an ambulance. Yes, she's at Memorial Hospital. Beth and I are on our way over. We'll call you when we get there.
Maybe we should take her purse or wallet or something. Beth was rummaging around Kimmy's dresser. Oh, she held up a prescription bottle. This says take one a day for depression. Do you think she overdosed?
I don't know,
Cheryl replied, retrieving her friend's purse from the floor of her dorm closet.
Better take it with us. I just can't believe this is happening. We better get going.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about protecting students' mental health on campus? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today has had personal experience that led to helping many people. Allison Malman is founder and executive director of Active Minds Incorporated, the only national organization dedicated to utilizing the student voice to raise mental health awareness on college campuses. Allison formed the organization in 2001, following the suicide of her only sibling, 22-year-old brother Brian. Wanting to combat the stigma that had caused her brother to suffer in silence and ultimately take his own life, she created a group on her campus at the University of Pennsylvania that promoted an open, enlightened dialogue around the issues. 2 years later, Allison formed the 501c3 nonprofit organization in order to develop and support chapters of this student group on campuses around the country. She currently runs Active Minds Incorporated, which has grown to over 100 chapters across the United States and Canada. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Allison.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
With the stresses of life on a college campus, how can a person tell if he or she has a serious mental problem?
Well, there are certain symptoms of serious mental health disorders that one can always look for. I think what's most important is to know that the only person who can really diagnose a serious disorder is a clinician, a psychologist or a psychiatrist. But there are certain signs that one can look for in oneself or friends, such as losing interest in things that were once interesting to you, oversleeping, sleeping too little, eating too much, eating too little. Having thoughts of suicide is one of the most telling signs of a serious depression or a serious mental health disorder. Thinking about dying, thinking about what it would be like if you were no longer there. I think what's also important is for us to realize that you don't necessarily need a serious mental health disorder to get help or to talk with friends or family members or clinicians about what you're going through. It's a fine line, and who's to say that you can only get professional help or you can only confide in a loved one if you have a serious diagnosable disorder? I think when we're talking about college students, young adults especially, it's a time of transition, of stress, anxiety, final exams, trying to figure out what you want to do with your life. And it's a really stressful time. And too often students feel like they need to take care of themselves and they need to be strong and they're on their own for the first time. And so they need to figure this all out. And it's a time that we all need to talk with each other and know that we're not alone in our struggles and know that there's help and support out there as we navigate the system and figure out what those answers are. There are websites and there are books that show the DSM-4 diagnoses of serious disorders, but at the same time, let's just talk about it anyway. Clinicians are available, friends and family are available for support, whether or not you have a serious diagnosable disorder.
I'm sorry, you said DSM-4, and that sounded like a government agency, but I don't know what it is.
The DSM-4 is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual to diagnose mental health disorders. So it's the book that clinicians refer to when you have 5 of these 10 symptoms for 3 weeks or longer, then you are diagnosed with depression or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. So it's the handbook that clinicians use to diagnose disorders.
Allison, is there a big difference between girls sharing their feelings and their problems with each other and guys of college age or high school age?
We see it typically in men and women in society, whether they're 5 or 50. I think when we look at college and high school age, a lot of young men will turn to drugs and alcohol if they're suffering from a depression or another mental health disorder, because that's where they know to turn. Oftentimes, women will turn to each other and confide in each other. A bit of that is stereotypical. Some guys will confide in each other or a female friend, and many young women won't share with each other. But we can certainly see oftentimes that young female friends will confide in each other a little bit more, and men tend to turn to some more destructive behaviors, self-injury as well as drug and alcohol abuse, other violent behaviors that may just be a mask for some internal mental health disorders or mental health problems that they're facing.
This question sort of dovetails on what we've been talking about, but is there any more to add about specific behaviors that friends who are on campus can look for that will be sort of a red flag?
Sure. The college age is a unique time in which young adults are on their own for the first time, and parents and siblings aren't necessarily watching their children or siblings on a daily basis, and friends are really the ones who are spending the most time with each other. And so I think friends have a really important role in both opening lines of communication with each other, but watching out for friends' behaviors and odd behaviors. And I think one of the things that friends will most likely see is really a loss of interest in activities that once interested the particular person. So if somebody used to be an avid runner and then gradually just weans off of running and isn't interested in it anymore, but doesn't give an explanation, it's not as though he or she is hurt, that's kind of a red flag. There are signs of serious depression and suicidal thoughts if a friend starts giving away possessions or says, hey, take my iPod, I don't need it anymore. There's a red flag right there. You know that your friend was an avid music listener and there's no reason that he or she would be giving it away. So there's some stark differences in that. And I think it's really important for friends to know that you don't necessarily have to know that a behavior is a symptom of depression or of bipolar disorder. But if you're worried about a friend, to go up to them and say, hey, I'm worried about you. You're not really acting the way you used to. Is there something you want to talk about? Can I help you with something? And then the friends have a role in helping their friend get into professional help. As young adults, we're not taught how to be clinicians, and it's not our job and it's not our responsibility. But we're the ones who see each other change behaviors much more frequently than parents necessarily will or faculty members on campus. So it's our role to really notice those changes and help them get into the professional help that they might need.
Now, I can just envision someone asking that kind of question of a friend and a guy shaking his head and saying, nah, then what? What do you do?
Well, you stay on them. You say, okay, well, if there's anything you ever want to talk about, let me know. The next week, if you're still noticing a problem, say, hey, I'm really noticing a problem. Somebody who is suffering doesn't necessarily want to recognize that they are or want to admit something right away, but to know that they have support, to know that they have somebody who understands that they might be going through something or somebody that they might be able to open up to, when that person gets ready to talk about it, they'll know that they have somewhere to go. It's important as the quote-unquote caregiver or as the friend who's trying to help their friend get into the help to know that they need to take care of themselves as well. So that person needs to talk to some other people just to know that they've got some allies or to know that they might need support as they're trying to help their friend get into that help that he or she may need. But it's not a once-and-done kind of question. Do you want to talk about something? No. Okay, well, we'll go on and pretend like nothing's going on. These issues are ever-evolving. They're not constant. They change all the time, and people experience them differently all the time as well. So just to make sure that we know that we all have a support network when we want it, when we're ready to use it, I think is really important, especially for students.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on mental health on campus.
Popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Allison Malman, Director of Active Minds Incorporated, about mental health on campus.
Can a friend go and talk to a professional, for example, a counseling service on campus, and say, I'm worried about my friend?
You can go straight to the counseling center. You can go to a residential assistant, an RA on campus. You can go to a teacher's assistant, whomever you may be close to on campus, but you can certainly go straight to a counseling center. Counseling centers are completely confidential, so you don't have to worry about the counselors broadcasting that your friend is depressed. That counseling center, that professional can help navigate the system so that your friend gets into whatever help he may need. The counselor may go straight to your friend's dorm if they're particularly worried, or they might help you set up a way to bring your friend over to them to see them.
How can parents be tuned into trouble if their son or daughter is living away from home?
It's a really hard question to answer. It's a predicament because so many students go off to college, as I said, just wanting to be on their own and feeling as though they need to take care of themselves and really wanting to break away from their parents. I think what's most important for parents from the minute you start talking about college, and even before, is opening a line of communication so that your children know that if they're ever experiencing anything that just doesn't feel right to them, they can talk to you about it. The communication lines can't be open necessarily if a student is in bed for 3 weeks with a depression and then all of a sudden you say, hey, you want to tell me about something? If we can open it up even earlier so that they know that they have you to talk with, if they're ever experiencing something that they don't quite understand, I think that's the best way to go, especially in the first couple of years of college when students have a new set of friends and they're not around the people who were once comforting to them. Parents at home can be really important players as long as those lines of communication is open. Another important relationship that can be developed is between friends and parents, so that if I may not necessarily call my mom and say, hey, mom, I think I'm depressed, but if my friend has a relationship with my friend may call my mom and tell her that. So there's multiple aspects and multiple avenues that we can keep this line of communication open, but I just think that's the most important thing. There's no one answer to that question. There's no go onto this website to find out if your child is depressed. But you just want to hope that they feel the confidence and the comfort in you that they can go to you if they need that help.
What happens if a parent is not able to connect with the friends and the student is not being forthcoming but the parent senses trouble? Can a parent call the counseling service? How does that privacy business work?
Privacy is a tough issue that's really being battled right now on campuses. There are some federal laws, the FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, as well as HIPAA, that protects a client's right within a counseling situation. But there are some rules within those that make it so that parents can get some access to some records. Within FERPA, if a student is still claimed as a dependent on your parent's tax return, you can still have access to some of the records. Counseling centers right now are going through an internal struggle deciding at what point do you bring parents into the conversation, because one of the really important parts on the other side of it is that if students know that their parents are going to have access to everything that they do, they may not go seek help. So there are quite a few counseling centers who, even though under FERPA parents can have access to some of those records, some counseling centers won't give them up for the privacy and protection of the student. So that's really handled on a case-by-case basis. And I think it's important for parents to recognize that it's not done so that they're shut out of their child's life, but so that the children feel comfortable seeking the help that they might need, and then the evolution of the treatment can happen from there.
Can counselors talk to parents, however, without sharing records, give parents advice or tell parents what they're seeing or any of that?
Counselors can always talk on a general level, advice. If you're worried about your student, these are things that we would advise you to do, taking out the specifics of the child. Person A can always say that to person B. What they're allowed to reveal is a very gray area that I don't necessarily think that I am the professional to be able to answer that question. But a parent can always call the counseling center just to get general advice. I'm worried about my kid. What should I do? What should I say? And that information can always be given up.
On most college campuses, what kind of institutional assistance is usually available? Is there, for example, a psychiatrist, an MD, psychologists, social workers? Whom do you see if you go for help?
It really depends on the campus. The vast majority, I can't say all, but 99.9% of campuses have a counseling center. But that counseling center can look very different on different campuses. There are some campuses where the counseling center is actually part of an academic counseling, and so there might be a part-time social worker on staff. Generally, those are the smaller schools. With large resource institutions, you can have a staff of 10 to 15 with part-time psychiatrists and social workers and PhD clinicians. Really depends on the school and the structure. There's a recommendation out that says that there should be one clinician on campus for every 1,100 students, which is actually more than there actually is, which is sad to say, but there are many schools with 3,000 or 4,000 students who may have one full-time clinician on staff. That clinician is usually a social worker, perhaps a PsyD, perhaps a PhD psychologist. Not all schools have psychiatrists on staff, but many schools have relationships. If they don't have a full-time staffed center on campus, a lot of them will have a relationship with a local mental health agency, so they can refer students to local mental health agencies in the community if they can't provide the services themselves. But it really is a case-by-case basis, and it's important as parents are looking and students are looking to go to college to really call the counseling center and say, what do you have? Who is on staff? how long is a wait period for a student who might need to seek help? And if they don't want to see you or if you don't have the capacity to see them, is there somebody that you can refer them to? Again, there's no one place where you can go to find out who's going to be on staff in any particular center. You really just have to call them or check out their website.
How effective are the peer counseling hotlines or the student-to-student kinds of organizations?
There hasn't been much research on it, so I can't say statistically, evaluatively, how effective they are. But as you referred to in your question, there are quite a few different roles that peers can play in supporting mental health and promoting mental health awareness on campus. There are some schools that have peer hotlines that are staffed solely by students who are trained by the counseling center or other clinicians on campus, usually run from 7 p.m. until 2 a.m., the time that students may actually need to talk with somebody. And on-staff clinicians are generally at home with their own families. And different schools, they're utilized on different levels. There are some schools where they don't really get many calls, and there are other schools where that's the place that students will go if they need help. Past the student-to-student clinical work is the work that students can do in raising awareness among their peers and educating their peers. So kind of serving as an outreach arm for a counseling center to say, hey, if you see these things in yourself or your friends, you should go to this counseling center. Let's help you get over to that counseling center. There's a new wave of kind of student advocacy and student awareness programs that have really been sprung up, and Active Minds is part of that, to encourage students to use their voice to educate about the issues, to destigmatize mental health and mental illness in a way that's really promoting awareness and promoting a dialogue around the issues so that students who do see friends who might be acting differently, they know what those signs are. They know what to do. They know what to say. They know where to go to seek help.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Active Minds?
Sure. I'd be happy to. Active Minds is the only national organization that is really dedicated to using the student voice to raise mental health awareness among young adults. And as was said in the introduction, I started it as an offshoot of the suicide of my brother, Brian. And I was a freshman on a college campus at the time that he died, and I reflected on kind of the trajectory of his illness and his death. And the short story of it is that he began experiencing symptoms of what was later diagnosed as schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of depression and psychosis and hearing voices. And he was diagnosed with that after taking a leave of absence from his school in his senior year, but he started experiencing it in his freshman year. And he didn't know what to say. His friends who noticed changes in him didn't know what to say. They didn't know how to help him. They didn't know if they should. He was ashamed for no reason. He thought he needed to pull himself out of it, and it was his job to do so. And so he suffered through what's supposed to be the best time of our lives on college, suffering with this serious, serious illness. And he was still able to maintain a 3.8 GPA. He became president of the a cappella group that he had joined. He became sports editor of the newspaper as well as columnist of the school newspaper. So he was succeeding academically, so nobody would ever figure anything out. But he was really suffering in isolation. And he finally took a voluntary leave of absence from his university in his senior year and came home and started intensive treatment. And that's when he was diagnosed, and that's when he started receiving the support that he needed. He ended up taking his life about a year and a half after taking that leave of absence. And I believe strongly that it was because that he felt so alone for such a long time, and that we have a very supportive family and we got great clinical help when he came home. But that was 3.5 years after first experiencing this. And so reflecting on his situation, knowing that he and I were very similar people, that I was a freshman when he died, I knew full well that I would have kept it all quiet myself if I had been in his situation. There was nobody talking about mental health issues on campus. There was nobody discussing depression, or nobody coming forward saying, hey, I have schizoaffective disorder, but I'm still on campus. I'm going to succeed. I'm going to graduate. I'm going to live the life that I want to live. So I started a group really for that purpose, to get students to tell their stories, to educate each other about the signs and symptoms so that people like my brother's friends would know what to say to their friends if they were worried about their behaviors, or Brian, people like Brian wouldn't feel like they needed to keep it all secret and they needed to keep it all hidden. Active Minds evolved from that student group on my campus to when I graduated, I formed the 501c3 with the goal to start chapters of that group on campuses around the country and really to empower young adults to be part of this movement and to be part of the education and the awareness that needs to happen around mental health in a way that right now is kind of done top down, or it's done clinician to patient in a way that I think further kind of stigmatizes the issues and makes fewer people really want to address them. Active Minds has grown from that one chapter at the University of Pennsylvania. We're now on over 100 college campuses. We have high school chapters as well, with students who are volunteers on campus working with the counseling center on their particular campus. They all have an advisor within the faculty or the counseling center, and they're working to promote awareness around the issues that affect their campus the most. So for some campuses, they're really focused on eating disorders. Some campuses do a little bit of bipolar disorder awareness and suicide prevention activities. All of our chapters run programs for stress relief and anxiety relief. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a serious anxiety disorder that we talk about. We should talk about the fact that we all get really stressed out around April and May when final exams, when a lot of people are graduating and they don't know what they're going to do with their lives and they think that they should know. A lot of people are going home for summer internships and they're really stressed out about that. So to do basic stress relief activities that way, to promote wellness, to promote a sense of self and a sense of self-acceptance and self-knowledge, and to know when something is serious that they should talk about it with a friend, with a family member, with a clinician, or when you can just go and share your story to know that you're not alone, to know that you're not the only person on campus who's dealing with what you're dealing with, because there are so many students who are dealing with things, and they're just kept so quiet that everybody feels like they're the only ones.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on mental health on campus.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Allison Malman, Director of Active Minds Incorporated, about mental health on campus. Do you think there are ways that freshmen can emotionally prepare for living away from the supports that they've been used to at home?
I think for each person it's a little bit different. Freshman year is certainly a time of transition, and it's a time of loss for many because they're losing their sense of comfort. I think as much as you can bring from your home environment to school can help, whether that be some of the home furnishings to make you feel more comfortable in your dorm room, whether it be making sure that the doctors that you are seeing, physical, mental, at home, can continue through your first year of college. You can see those same people. Stay connected with friends from high school as you go through college. Don't necessarily see college as a time to totally start fresh and start new, because that's a real sense of change and of loss. So taking what you can from home and bring it to your first year can help that transition. But again, for every student, it's going to be a little bit different, and there's going to be something a little bit different for each person that needs to be brought. But to know that college is supposed to be the best time of your life, but it's not just going to happen that way. You got to work at it. You got to enjoy it. You got to know that there's the good and the bad that go along with it.
There's been so much in the news for so long about students on campus with mental illness then resorting to violence and so forth. Is there a myth that we are buying into that we shouldn't buy into?
I think it's been easy for the media especially to jump into the conclusion that, oh, because this person was mentally ill, that's why he did this. Or because this person was taking medication or was off his medication, that's why he did this. And I think one of the most important things for everybody to know is that the vast majority of people who have a mental health disorder, who have mental illness, are not violent, and they're actually more likely to be victims of violence than they are perpetrators. And if we continue to propel the notion that this person is so violent because he has mental illness, then students who need help are going to be hesitant to go seek that help because they don't want to be labeled as that person with mental illness who's going to be violent. So for us all to know that you can live a successful life with a mental illness, most people with mental illness are contributing members to society. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's something you live with, and it's something you learn to cope with, but it's not necessarily a life sentence, and it doesn't necessarily mean you are going to be as violent as we've seen in some of the recent tragedies that have happened on college campuses. And it's just important for us all to remember that so that everybody who needs help feels comfortable seeking it and doesn't feel like they're going to have that added level of stigma that they may feel the way the media is kind of perpetrating a lot of this discussion.
Allison, what resources would you suggest if our listeners would like to pursue some of these issues further?
Well, of course, I would recommend the Active Minds website, which is www.activeminds.org. There are a couple of great websites for students themselves who might be interested, or parents who want to see how students are viewing mental health issues. There's a website called Half of Us. halfofus.org, which is www.halfofus.org. And that's a joint partnership by MTVU and the Jed Foundation. The Jed Foundation is a foundation based in New York that's oriented towards suicide prevention for college students. And they have a lot of great PSAs and some information for students about mental health disorders on there. There are some other national groups that can give you some more information about particular mental health disorders or support groups in your area. There's the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, which is dbsa.org, as well as the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is nami.org, and Mental Health America, which is nmha.org. All of those national groups actually have local affiliates in communities and state-based affiliates, so they can connect you with clinicians and support groups in the area. But for students, they get a lot of their information online. So I would recommend halfofus.org and the Active Minds website.
Well, this has been an enlightening and a heartening conversation. And Allison Malman, thank you so much for helping us to understand mental illness better and what we can do for students on college campuses.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure to be here.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Please mention show number 362, and if you can, tell us what station you're tuning in from.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. At the end of our program, we often thank individuals or foundations for generous donations that help with the cost of producing Parents Perspective. Parents Perspective is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Today it is our turn to thank you, our listeners, for your tax-deductible contributions to our annual fundraising campaign. Please send checks or money orders to Parents Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. Thank you for helping us continue to work for you. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.